Well, good morning. Welcome. We're in the book of Matthew. Matthew chapter 26. Jesus has been agonizing, literally agonizing in prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. On the Mount of Olives in an olive grove. He has gone three times to the Lord and beginning by asking if he's checking, last check with his authority, do I understand it correctly? Is this what I have to do? Is there any other way? And then he says, but not my will, but thine be done. Then the second, the third time, he seems to say, basically strengthen me if this can't change. And his disciples are weary. One of the writers says that they were weary because of sorrow. He was sorry. They were sorry. They were agonizing. They just fell asleep. So he woke them up twice, but third time he said, just go ahead and sleep. Evidently, a little bit later, he could hear the soldier band coming and see the lights in the darkness. And so he woke them up in that surprise thing to them. Peter advances with his sword and inexpertly slices off the right ear of one of the servants of the high priest, Malchus, and Christ, in control, touches the wound and heals the ear. We now hear him speaking to the group that has come to arrest him in verses 55 and 56, the council of peace and forsaking. In the same hour said Jesus to the multitudes, are ye come out as against a thief with swords and staves for to take me? They were armed because that was what the chief priests did. They were expecting. You can almost realize that people will expect you to react to things like they would. If you don't, if you take a Christian position, they will be surprised. So it was here with the scribes and the Pharisees. They were all about power. They were all about authority. They were rejecting the one that they knew was the Son of God so that they could keep their power. We're going to find that it didn't take too great a spiritual understanding. Pilate himself is going to realize that this is all about envy. So they said, his gang will probably try to attack you, try to escape, see? So he says, are you come out as against a thief with swords and staves for to take me? It's me. I sat daily with you teaching in the temple. You laid no hold on me. But all this was done, Matthew explains, that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. So to this hostile multitude, Jesus calmly reasons. He was no violent thief. He was a gentle teacher of God's love, God's truth. He marveled that such a force was gathered to bring him, to bring in a rabbi, you know. Perhaps awe and shame mixed to make the multitude violent. Acting against their own conscience often causes people to act very badly. They took Jesus and the disciples fled. Matthew explains all this was done that the scriptures might be fulfilled, that it was in fact the will of God. Jesus was abandoned in this tragic hour. He would face the night alone, the mob against one man. But from his steadfast courage would come salvation and restoration, even for those who had forsaken him and fled. the whole story of the restoration of Peter is a beautiful story, one that he, from then on, never felt he was worthy of. The majestic Christ may have impressed those in the multitude that arrested him, perhaps some, because became his followers on the day of Pentecost and afterward. I'd like to think so. These who could think back at what happened before his resurrection. The resurrection pretty well stated he was everything that he said he was. Well, we come to the trials of Jesus, chapter 26, 57 through chapter 27, 31. We see the appearances, first of all, before the Jewish court, and this trial before the Sanhedrin at night. The Sanhedrin was the ruling body. We see, first of all, at Anna's house. We have to go to John for this. Matthew skips over this as being, I guess, essentially unimportant, but here's the story from John 18. And led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. How all of this worked, I'm not quite sure, but Annas, his father-in-law to the high priest, was given first opportunity for this Jesus guy. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews, that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. He presented it as though we leaders of the Jews are the best for the people. That if Jesus, if the Messiah takes over, there will be rebellion against Rome, and that would be bad. That's the thinking, see. So he says, instead of the people dying, we'll have this man die, we'll kill this man. And that'll be a good thing. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. That disciple was known unto the high priest. This is the way John spoke of himself. He never named himself. He just said it was the other disciple. And so John says that he knew, that was known of the high priest, and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. So Peter and John were following, but Peter stood at the door without. Then went out that other disciple, which was known of the high priest, and spake unto her that kept the door, and brought in Peter. John was a little more gentle of the disciples and had spent a lot of time with the priestly people. Yes, sir?
In that time and era, writing about yourself in the third person was considered appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah.
When Julius Caesar wrote his biography, he wrote it all in third person.
Yeah.
That's probably also why Paul, that it likely was that Paul was talking about himself when he talked about the man.
The one being caught up to heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why he did it that way, because it was considered proud to write it yourself in the first person.
And John, very clearly, was not a proud person. So now Peter and John have come in. They can follow what's going on. But Peter feels alone here. Then saith the damsel that kept the door unto Peter, art not thou also one of this man's disciples? And he could have said yes, but I think in this point he's there witnessing the trial of his master. And he was afraid. He saith, I'm not. And the servants and the officers stood there and made a fire of coals, for it was cold. And they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them that which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. And this was to say, this isn't the first time you've heard of me or about me or from me. So don't make a pretense in this that I'm going to say something new. And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand. And Brother Jeb, maybe you can explain this to me, but I noticed that whenever it talks about the striking with the palm, it says, or with a rod. The King James margin says that. So, yeah, seems like we would be able to tell the difference in Greek between a stick and a palm, but it may be struck him with the hand, would be the idea. So it could refer to something being held in the hand or the hand itself. But there are a few things that hurt more than being struck with an open hand on the face. Yeah, okay. He was struck by means of the hand. Yeah. All right, well, just keep in mind as you see that, this is the King James translator said, we could have put it this way, but it seemed more like it was the palm of the hand. And so he strikes him and says, answerest thou the high priest so? Jesus answered him, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. He wasn't getting anywhere. He was hoping that he would say something that would trip Jesus up. But he was beyond that. So we find that both Peter and John recovered before any other disciple. Recovered in following Jesus. They both followed Jesus. John was known to the high priest, was allowed in. John got Peter in. Peter here first denied that he was a disciple like John. So Jesus did not play the game they were trying to play. They wanted him to tell his teachings that they might catch him in a misstatement. He said that others who had heard him could answer. Contrary to the law, they began to hit him. The whole procedure was highly illegal since they were not to hold trials like this at night. This is similar to our business meeting rules that we have to announce it 2 weeks in advance so that we're not waiting till everybody's gone and then hold a business meeting and get something passed with the people that are here. That was their rules here. Don't have it at night. It needs to be in the daylight. It has to be announced. It has to be all above board. We see then that they moved to Caiaphas' house. Matthew now takes it up. They that laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. Mark 14, they led Jesus away to the high priest. With him were assembled all the chief priests and elders and scribes. This would be a description of the Sanhedrin. So then Peter's daring pursuit. But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants to see the end, how this was going to end up. Mark 14, Peter followed him afar off even unto the palace of the high priest, and he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. Again, he's trying to blend in. There were several things about him that didn't blend in. One is he had been seen with Jesus all this time, he was a prominent disciple. He was sort of the captain of the disciples. Jesus would tell him something to tell the disciples, and when asking the disciples about something, he would usually ask Peter. So he seems to be the captain of the team. Then the use of false witnesses. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witnesses against Jesus to put him to death. They didn't care whether it was true or not. They were trying to ram through this legality thing. They needed to have a crime bad enough that they could take it to the Romans, because the Jews weren't allowed to kill their prisoners legally. But found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. So the false witnesses were ready to say anything, but they had like goofy testimonies. Nancy.
It's almost like there was a job code that's called false witnesses, and they just
dragged
them all in.
Yeah. This just in. But they found none. At the last came two false witnesses and said, "This fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days." And the high priest arose and said unto him, "Answerest thou nothing? What is that which these witnesses, what is it which these witnesses against thee?" But Jesus held his peace. he had said, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again." And that was the temple of his body. Mark 14 tells us this: "The chief priests and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death and found none, for many bear false witness against him, but their witnesses agreed not together." And that was the big problem. There was no consistency. Then arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, "We heard him, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands." That's not what he said. "And within 3 days I will build another made without hands." So this was their interpretation, and that was why it was a false witness. But there were two of them that agreed together, so now there was the witness of two or three. They could take that. "But neither so did their witness agree together. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But he held his peace and answered nothing." So the purpose of these was to find a legal basis on which Jesus could be condemned to death to the Romans. They gathered false witnesses, couldn't get them to agree. Finally, two agreed, "I am able to destroy the temple of God, build it in 3 days," but this was not sufficient ground for condemnation. Jesus, again, did not play along. In desperation, the high priest addresses him, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses against thee?" He desires Christ to make claims that could be interpreted as blasphemy. Well, he gets that because Christ is now going to give testimony of his deity. This is a dangerous game they're playing, because if you're dealing with someone who claims to be God, either they are blaspheming or you are. They're either what they say or they're not. If they're not, then they are blaspheming. If they are, then you're being careful. You're being blasphemous by denying it. So you would have to examine those claims. You would have to be very careful in that. "And the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ," the Messiah, "the Son of God." They understood this to mean part of God, being God. "Jesus saith unto them, Thou hast said. Nevertheless, I say unto thee, hereafter shall ye," plural, "see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Clarified that. You're going to see not only me again, but I'm going to be on a throne of power and returning to earth. "Then the high priest rent his clothes." They had a little rental agency off the side. Rent the high priest's clothes. No, he was tearing his clothes and saying, "He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye?" They answered and said, "He is guilty of death." Yay, we finally got to where we wanted to be all along. Mark 14, 61 to 64. "Again the high priest asked him, said unto him, Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus said, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, coming in the clouds of heaven." When he says, "I am," this was even more of a digging of the knife in them. Yet it was a true witness. He's actually saying to them, "You need to be careful with what you're doing here. They had already believed that he was, or that everything seemed to point to that. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, the right hand of the Father, coming in the clouds of heaven. And the high priest rent his clothes and said, "What need we of any further witnesses? Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye?" They all condemned him to be guilty of death. This was the vote of the Sanhedrin, the rulers of Israel. So Jesus not only claimed to be the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, but he added that he would be enthroned at the right hand of God and then return to earth in clouds of heaven as the predicted Messiah, the King. This clear claim of deity prompted the high priest to tear his clothes. If Christ's claim had been untrue, it would indeed have been blasphemy. What the chief priests and scribes ignored was the fact that Jesus had not only made the claim before, but that he had fully supported it by the very credentials and miracles that the Old Testament had attributed to him. They were the ones ignoring the evidence. Then we see the abuse of Jesus. "Then did they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms or rods of their hands, saying, Prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee?" Evidently, they blindfolded him or came up behind him and slapped him. "You know everything. Prophesy. Who was it that smote you?" Mocking him, you see. In Mark 14:65, "Some began to spit on him and to cover his face, to buffet him, and say unto him, Prophesy. And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands." So, contrary to both Jewish law and Roman law, they abused him. And this cowardly abuse was not limited to servants. The text indicates that the Sanhedrin itself lowered its dignity to participate. Fact is, they just hated Jesus and delighted in this opportunity to hurt him. In all this abuse, Jesus was silent. He was ready to answer sincere questions of faith, but not the slanted questions of unbelief. Mark and Luke point out that they covered his face, began to strike him, and mockingly ask him to use divine revelation to tell who did it. Now we see the three denials by Peter. The first denial, now Peter was sat without at the palace, and a damsel came unto him saying, we had already seen that in John. He denied before them all, "I know him not." Mark 14, "As Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, And thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied, I know not, neither understand what thou sayest. And he went out into the porch, and the cock crew." Luke 22, "They took him and led him, brought him into the high priest's house. Peter followed afar off. When they had enkindled a fire in the midst of the hall, were sat down together. Peter sat down among them, but a certain maid beheld him as he sat by the fire, earnestly looked upon him, and said, This man was also with him. And he denied him, saying, Woman, I know him not." In John 18, we saw earlier, but Jesus denying that he knows him. John Broadus says, "We see from John that the first denial was made while Annas was questioning Jesus. It's clear from comparing all the narratives that the second and third were made while Jesus still remained at the high priest, Caiaphas' house, and Peter in the court, probably during the trial by the informal meeting of the Sanhedrin. So Peter was drawn to the scene. He desperately wanted to know what would become of Jesus. Peter sat without in the palace means that he was not in the audience room where Jesus was appearing before the authorities. But the palace was like the plaza or the court outside. The first to detect Peter's identity was one of the maids of the high priest. Peter was loud in his denial. The second denial, "When he was gone out into the porch, another maid saw him and said unto him that were there, This fellow also was also with Jesus of Nazareth. And again he denied with an oath. And an oath could mean, I swear to God, I do not know the man. We see it in Mark 14, a maid saw him again, began to say to him that stood by, this is one of them, and he denied it again. Luke 22, after a little while, another saw him and said, thou art also of them. Peter said, man, I am not. Then John 18, Simon Peter stood, warmed himself. They said, therefore unto him, art thou not also one of his disciples? He denied it and said, I am not. You put it all together and you see one accusing, the others joining in, asking questions. So Peter then went out into the porch area to warm himself. Another maid accuses him of being with Jesus, one of the disciples. This time Jesus denied more emphatically and even denied with an oath that he did not know Jesus. And then the third denial, and after a while came unto him they that stood by and said to Peter, they've been talking about it, pointing and talking in the dark, surely thou art one of them, for thy speech bewrayeth thee. You sound like one of the hick Galileans, you see. Then began he to curse and to swear. After all, he'd been a fisherman, right? So he knew how to do that. Saying, I know not the man. And immediately the cock crew. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus, which said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And he went out and wept bitterly. He was trying to be this macho man, but when he realized that all of this, you know, big talk about everybody forsaking, but I will give my life, he says, and here I am afraid of maids and servants and rumors. And he went out. This was a significant going out. This was, in my opinion, this was Peter resigning the discipleship, saying, I am no longer worthy to even be called a disciple. Mark 14, a little after, they that stood by said to Peter, surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto. But he began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not the man of whom you speak. The second time the cock crew, Peter called to mind the word which Jesus said unto him, before the cock crows twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. When he thought thereon, he wept abundantly, or he began to weep. Luke 22, about the space of 1 hour after, another confidently affirmed, saying, of a truth this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean. Peter said, man, I know not what thou sayest. And immediately, while he yet spake, the cock crew. Now notice this. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. Luke's the only one that mentions that. Wouldn't that just be it? Peter remembered the word of the Lord. I had said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. John says, one of the servants of the high priest, being his kinsman, kinsman of Malchus, saith, did not I see thee in the garden with him? He was there. He remembered that face of anger as the sword came down. Peter then denied again, and immediately the cock crew. The third denial came sometime later, as Luke says, came when a group led by one man accused him. Matthew, they; Mark, they; Luke, another, indicating a singular person; John, a servant of the high priest. Peter was, of course, talking, and he sounded like a Galilean. Bereithi means literally, makes thee manifest, makes you clear you're a Galilean, as if to prove he was not a follower of the Holy One. Jesus began to curse and to swear. Broadus explains, cursing would, in such a case, be invoking a curse upon himself if he were speaking falsely, and so would be even stronger than an oath. The Jews were much given to a careless use of oaths, and it may be, as Alexander supposes, that Peter relapsed under the excitement unto an early habit, which he had abandoned through the Savior's teaching. Mark records that the cock crowed twice, which reminds Peter of the warning Jesus had given him. Before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. Luke records that Jesus turned and looked at him. Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote a poem, The Meaning of the Look. I think that look of Christ might seem to say, thou, Peter, art thou then a common stone? Peter, Petros, the rock. Art thou a common stone which I at last must break my heart upon? For all God's charge to his high angels may guard my foot better. May I yesterday wash thy feet, my beloved, that thou shouldst run quick to deny me neath the morning sun, and do thy kisses like the rest betray? The cock crows coldly. Go and manifest a late contrition, but no bootless fear. For when thy final need is dreariest, thou shalt not be denied as I am here. My voice to God and angels shall attest, because I know this man, let him be clear. Peter, there before Christ, had proclaimed he was willing to die for this Lord more than any other, now faced that bitter truth, tested and failed. Matthew and Luke tells us that he went out and wept bitterly. Some of the early Latin hymns refer to a legend that all through life Peter never heard a cock crow without weeping. I think perhaps you and I have experienced enough betrayal of Jesus that we don't feel so haughty when we hear what Peter did, but certainly heartbreaking. We see then the formal condemnation at dawn. And when the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And of course, they needed the Roman work then. When they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Perhaps knowing that their trials before Annas and Caiaphas that night were illegal, both in the way they were conducted and in their outcome, the chief priests and elders reviewed their case against Jesus at a meeting held the next morning. Mark tells us straightway in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate. How are we going to get this done? Luke 23:1, the whole multitude of them arose, led to Pilate. John 18, led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, or Pilate's house. And it was early. They themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. So it was not yet Passover. They're keeping themselves not defiled by entering a Gentile's house. So perhaps the only question they had dealt with, the fact that they did not have the authority to put Jesus to death. This could be done only by a Roman ruler. Jesus was bound, led away to be delivered to Pontius Pilate, the governor, for the first of three trials before Roman rulers. So what we find here is that they're consulting now. Now it's okay for us to kill him. We wanted to kill him anyway, but now we're very clear that he's committed the act of blasphemy. Therefore, we have every right to kill him. We don't have that authority. So now what we've got to do is to find some reason for the Romans to kill him. Well, let's just begin looking at the remorse and suicide of Judas. Before proceeding with the account of the trial of Christ, Matthew records the remorse of Judas. What's going through his mind? Whatever it is, Satan's done with him now. Toss him aside like a used Kleenex, you know. Judas repents. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. He proclaims him to be innocent. He betrayed him knowing he was innocent. And they said, what is that to us? See thou to that. So Judas realizes that Jesus has been condemned. This seems to be a surprise to him. Was he so confused to think that somehow in the trial these rulers would say, oh, now we see he's the Son of God. He hadn't pictured the whole animosity and the virulent hatred. So he repented of his act. He attempted to return the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. I don't know what he was thinking. Did he think, okay, I'll give you the money back, you give me Jesus? I don't know. Evidently, Judas did not expect the arrest of Jesus to lead to his condemnation. He seems to try to undo it all by returning the money, while his feelings concerning the claim of Jesus to be Messiah may still have been mixed with unbelief. He knew that Jesus was not worthy of death. The priests, however, were quite unconcerned and threw the problem back at him. So Judas commits suicide. He cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself, being spurned by them. Judas went to the temple, hurled the silver into the sanctuary, the Greek naos, meaning the entrance to the holy place. And then he went out and hanged themselves. They're going to find that money later, realize what it was, and use it for something. And that's what he explains. The use of the money of betrayal. The chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them into the treasury because of the price of blood. How meticulous they are here, you know, to be holy. We can't use this. We paid it for blood unto this day. they took counsel and bought with them, with that pieces of money, the potter's field to bury strangers in. Wherefore that field is called the field of blood unto this day. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value, or whom they bought of the children of Israel, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord appointed me. We're going to talk about that later, but let me explain what was going on here. This price of blood, that really only makes sense after Jesus has died. So while it's being spoken here, for the story's sake, it hasn't happened yet. In fact, they're all involved with the whole crucifixion thing. They're not in there locating stray pieces of silver. So what happened is that Judas went out to a lonely place, an abandoned field that evidently had a strong enough tree, and he hung himself. He was evidently not found for even a few days, with everything in Jerusalem being in sort of an uproar, I think. He was ripening on a tree. So the story is in Acts that when he was finally found and cut down, it didn't turn out well. Men and brethren, Peter is talking in Acts 1:16, this scripture must needs have been fulfilled, which the Holy Ghost, by the mouth of David, spoke before concerning Judas, which was guide to them that took Jesus, for he was numbered with us and obtained part of this ministry. Now this man purchased a field with the reward of iniquity. Now think about this. Peter is saying Judas purchased the field by the price of his iniquity. So that's the 30 pieces of silver. Now obviously he hung himself, so he wasn't negotiating for a field. But you see what happened here. And falling headlong, he burst asunder in the midst and all his bowels gushed out. So somebody cut the rope, and he just popped open. So they said, well, so much for wrapping him up and taking him to a tomb. So basically they took shovels and turned the dirt over. But then there was this question about the money, so they went back and they purchased the field that he had defiled with that very money. And it was known unto all the dwellers at Jerusalem, insomuch that the field called in their proper tongue Hakel Dama, that is to say, the field of blood. So we find that comparing it all, Jesus went to the barren field, hung himself with all the activity. He was not discovered for days. He was found and cut down. His body burst open. The men buried him right there. The priests were evidently notified. There had been some debate over what to do with the money. They said, oh, we can't put it in our holy treasury. So it was used to buy the field that became known as the field of blood, and we used to bury strangers. Now, next time we'll go into this reference to a prophecy from the Old Testament, and I think most of the commentators that talk about it have misunderstood this, and we'll call in Gleason Archer to clear it up for us. Comments or questions then on what was going on with Jesus in this lesson? All right, well, let's stand together. We'll be dismissed with a word of prayer. Our Father, thank you for the story of Jesus. We thank you that even in the hands of those who were so much his enemy, that hated him personally so much, we find that he was pure, he was calm, he was not belligerent. We thank you that he has shown us the path when persecuted is not in retaliation, but in trust to you. We ask that you might help us then to follow in his steps, as Peter tells us, to recognize that persecution will come, but we don't have to be taking the idea of avengers and terrorists. So guide and direct us then to realize that in the trial, the only thing that could have been definitely established was that he was the Son of God. So guide and direct us as we put our faith and trust in him and in him alone. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.